Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to GoTo Book Club. Today, I, Trisha G, will be interviewing Charles Humble about his not book, which is bookish. Hello and welcome, Charles.
Hi, Trisha. Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. Let's first caveat my whole thing about it's a not book. So can you please describe the project to me?
I can. So I did pitch it as a book, funny enough. So I had this idea for a long time. That was kind of one of those things that's a bit kind of nascent and not very well formed. But the starting point from it was I gave a talk actually at GoTo and then also at DevOps UK about writing as an engineer. So not writing for a group of engineers, but being an engineer who writes. And I kind of imagined that I'd have like five people in the room or, you know, be talking to a camera on my own or something. And as it turned out, both times the room was really full. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then I'd kind of had this weird idea for a while that if I look over my career, for want of a better word, what success I've had that wasn't like purely luck wasn't down to my ability to program. It was mostly down to other things that had nothing to do with programming at all, like being able to talk to executives in a reasonably intelligent way, being able to do presentations, understanding how systems thinking worked and how critical thinking worked. Understanding all kinds of different communication patterns and all of those sorts of things. So I had this kind of weird nascent idea of maybe someone should do a book about, you know, I hate to use soft skills, but you know, that sort of idea of things that are not programming that might be helpful for you to know as a programmer. And it was a sort of a bit of a half-formed idea, and I pitched it to O'Reilly and they were brilliant and said, first of all, we don't really think this is a book. But we do think there's something here. And so I kind of iterated with an editor there who was wonderful. And she kind of helped me take these kind of rather half-formed thoughts and come up with a structure. And so what we ended up doing this is a series of what O'Reilly calls shortcuts. So they are basically a series of connected articles. So there are 14 of these and they're kind of grouped into sort of different topical areas. So we've got a group on communication, a group on critical thinking, a group on documentation, and a group on networking. And that's basically how it kind of came together. So you can think of each of those groups as a bit like a chapter. And then within each of those, you've got sort of three or four articles of about sort of 1,000, 1,500 words or something like that. They vary a little bit in terms of length. So that's kind of how it came to be. I suppose the other sort of input to that was so when I learned to program in the 1980s as a schoolboy on like 8-bit computers, you know, the Commodore 64 and things like that. The Commodore 64 in particular is a really interesting piece of hardware because for a start, it was small enough that you could learn what everything did, like right down to what every individual chip and buffer and everything was for. And also because you could do all sorts of weird, interesting things with it. Like you could store bits of compressed code in the tape buffer, for example, and then explode that into main memory, which meant you could have more than 64K of programming in your 64K machine and things like that. It's all really good fun. And the reason I know all of that sort of thing was because people wrote articles in magazines with actual listings that you could actually type in where they would explain what they were doing. And that was kind of how I imagined the industry would be. And then when I went off and read English literature, I don't actually have a computer science degree. So I read English literature for 3 years, mostly to annoy an English teacher who told me I shouldn't. And then after that, kind of gradually made my way in to be a professional software engineer. Started in desktop support, kind of worked my way up. But one of the things that I found really surprising when I joined was that code had become this kind of weird secret thing that we didn't really talk about and we didn't really explain. And while open source has obviously changed that, and that's a fine and wonderful thing, and reading code and contributing to open source projects is absolutely a good and worthwhile learning experience for people and a good thing to do in general. I also think that as an industry, we need to be really much better at explaining what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think that we suffer rather from this idea that somehow communication isn't for us. And I think it's never been more important, because what's happened to us as an industry is we've got to a point where we have a massive and pervasive influence on all kinds of things. You know, our work has a huge and profound impact, and we're very bad at explaining it. So, and that's kind of another seed of what I have going on in my own sort of mind about it, is we just need to get better at this. And I firmly believe that this is all stuff you can learn. I don't think there's some, you know, I'm not saying you can, you know, be the next Jeanette Winston or something and write kind of wonderful gossamer thin novel type prose. I think that's something that you probably can't learn how to do unless you've got a sort of innate ability, but you can absolutely learn how to communicate factual information clearly and how to, you know, do critical thinking and how to assimilate information and all of that kind of thing. And so that's kind of the other part of this. I really think we need to get better at this, because if we don't, as an industry, I think we're in real trouble.
Yes, I violently agree with all of that stuff. You've also answered my first like five questions in one question.
Sorry.
But I completely agree. And in fact, I thought about writing a similar book. I was going to call it Politics for Programmers or something like that. Because again, all about these like different, these non-technical skills. I should mention the name of the not book, Professional Skills for Software Engineers.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's kind of broken down into communication, critical thinking, documentation and networking. Yeah. So I violently agree with all of this. And you, right at the beginning there, you mentioned the term soft skills. I had this as the last question I was going to ask you. I'm going to ask you now, you know, the things that you're covering are often traditionally lumped under this term soft skills. How do you feel about the term soft skills? Do you love it, hate it?
I loathe it with the passion of a thousand burning suns. I think it's hugely and enormously unfortunate, because it has this implication that programming is the hard bit and the people and communication and that stuff is somehow the easy bit, or the sort of soft and squidgy bit. And I think that's completely the wrong way around. I actually think programming on the whole is not the hard thing. Knowing what to build and how to build it, that's difficult. And that involves learning how to communicate in various different ways. So I have a real aversion to the term. It's kind of the term that we seem to be stuck with. I don't really have a better one. I mean, people skills doesn't really work and doesn't really cover it. A lot of this stuff actually does come under systems thinking. So that might in some ways be a better term to use, but the problem with that is that comes with a whole load of baggage as well. So I kind of feel like this is a term that we're stuck with, but it's really, really unfortunate. It's a bit like, you know, artificial intelligence being the term we use for what we call artificial intelligence, which is quite literally neither of these things. It's a very unfortunate choice of language. But in a way, that's almost sort of to my point. We're bad at words. We're bad at naming things, because naming things is hard, right? And so, you know, we're kind of stuck with this awful term, soft skills, I think for a lot of us, it's probably the same. It kind of, you know, it's like fingernails down the blackboard of my soul or something. I loathe it, but I don't have a better term.
It tends to make engineers in particular, like you say, devalue these skills, because, I mean, I guess at least, you know, it's not called, if you've got soft skills and hard skills, at least it's not called easy skills and hard skills.
Yes, but, that's true.
You know, there is this implication that it's somehow, like you say, squishy, perhaps not as important, and maybe just something you can do without really investing enough time. But again, and then, so this is why what you said right at the beginning really resonated with me. The fact that you said at the beginning, these are all learnable skills. These are all skills that if we put a bit of time and effort into, we get better at. Of course, there's going to be some things that we are naturally better at than others, but like programming, like anything else, if you invest some time in some of these skills, then, you know, you will get better at it.
Absolutely. And it will pay dividends as well if you do, which is the other point. I think I think one of the very unfortunate things about it is because we undervalue this, we under-test for it.
Yes.
We tend, when we interview people, when we're looking for engineers, a lot of that's done with, you know, coding exercises or whiteboard exercises or whatever it is. And that's a whole another rant I could very happily go off on. But skipping lightly over that for a moment, it's really hard to test critical thinking on a whiteboard. It's really hard to test communication skills on a whiteboard. But because we undervalue it, what tends to happen is we tend to promote people a lot based on their programming skills and their programming efficiency. And we don't tend to promote people nearly as much or pay people nearly as much for doing the things that we value less. And that, I think, has all kinds of quite major ramifications for us as an industry that are, should we
and
say,
it's
not
interesting,
good.
Actually, because you've already mentioned that being better at these skills that are mentioned in your notebook, and being better at these skills make you better at building the right thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm paraphrasing, but if you can communicate with humans and find out what they want, and if you can do the critical thinking and problem solving, you're more likely to build the right thing sooner than if you just start hacking at the computer. Now, there's a in my mind, given that we do not do a good job of measuring our abilities as developers, don't really know what our jobs really are as engineers, and measure and evaluate all the wrong things, there's a tendency, I think, to overlook those folks who can build the right thing faster first mm-hmm. time, because they make it look easy, instead of actually valuing the fact that they went out, they spoke to the person, they did the critical thinking, they did the right thing first time, instead of having to write more code, do more commits and go backwards and forwards and take longer on it.
Yep, all of that is true. It's not universally true, which is the good news, but it is very, very common. In fact, one of the things we quite often do is we promote the very worst people. And we promote the very worst people because the very worst people tend to, you know, work 24 hours a day and hack away because there's a crisis. And we ignore the
hero thing.
Crisis, yeah, the kind of hero programmer thing, right? And we tend to promote those people because they make a lot of noise. And so they draw attention to themselves. And they are absolutely not the people we should be promoting. But the good news is that is kind of culturally specific. So something that it took me a really long time to learn is that in the better cultures, in the places, let me rephrase that, in the places where I personally have been happiest professionally, we've tended to value the people that are doing it well, rather than the people who are doing it the noisiest, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Having read the section on networking that you have towards the end, you can read it whichever order you want to, but the section on networking reminded me of exactly this point. And I have a talk, Career Advice for Programmers, and one of the things I do in that is I talk about, it's not enough to be good at your job. You have to tell people that you're good at your job. You have to show people that you're there, that you're doing stuff, and you have to show them the best of yourself. And you sort of have to make noise about yourself, because otherwise you're not necessarily going to get promoted. You're not necessarily going to get those opportunities. If people are in the office for longer, they tend to get noticed more. If they are the ones to dive in and fix the difficult bugs, they are going to get noticed more. So these hero programmers tend to be noticed more. And so I like the fact that you've got the networking section, because I think those are the kinds of skills that will help you get noticed for the things that you're actually good at. And I think that's a key skill.
100%. And it's the thing about it is the underlying thing here is it's a whole bunch of things that intersect. And the reason that I ended up with this sort of the 14 of them is because you kind of need all of them to varying degrees and varying proportions. But yes, absolutely. Networking in various different ways is a really key part of that, because it's a way of, I mean, I'm not a great, you know, blower of my own trumpet on the whole. I feel very uncomfortable going out and saying, look at how wonderful I am. But there are ways that I can do that that don't make me uncomfortable. And you do have to. Right. You do have to let people know. The flip side of that, I think, is a good manager should be giving you the information you need to get promoted. So they should be telling you these are the things that I am looking for as a manager. These are the things that I expect. So for example, if you're going from being, you know, a programmer to your first management position, that becomes usually is a thing about, are you mentoring a team or mentoring individuals on a team? Are you lifting the whole team's ability up rather than just focusing on your own thing? And that's one of the things we're looking for. And a good manager should be telling you that as well. But equally, you know, your career is your career, right? You have to, if your manager isn't having that conversation with them, maybe you should have it with them. Maybe you should be saying, how do I do that?
This is my key message in career advice for programmers, which is that you're the one who has to live with your career and you're the one who owns your career. So maybe you're fortunate and you have a manager or even a career structure inside your organization, which is going to help you level up. In my experience and in the experience of speaking to a lot of other people, like lots of organizations, particularly startups and smaller technical organizations, just don't have that. Mm-hmm. So you do need to take control of your own career and you do need to, there are things you can do to improve your career that management might not tell you about. And the things that you've put in these articles are exactly the kinds of things that are going to help you with your career. So you don't need to rely on a manager or a structured career path to sort of supercharge really your career path.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right. I hope so.
And actually that kind of, one of the questions I wanted to ask earlier on, but I got so interested in the conversation, I didn't ask it, is who are these articles for? Like, who is this advice for?
That's a really great question. Actually, I spent a lot of time on this. I think it's around about the point when you're thinking about moving from being an individual contributor to being perhaps a manager or perhaps like a more senior engineer. It's kind of at that junior to intermediate to senior point. The slight problem with articles is we do have job title inflation in our industry that's fairly rampant. So that's maybe a lot of people have like a senior job or a manager title where they're not actually managing people. But a lot of this was things I wish someone had told me before I got my first management position. That was a lot of it was looking back at the awful things I did as a manager when I had no idea what I was doing. I had in a way, a very unfortunate thing that most of the managers I had were actually very good managers. And the problem with that is it's really hard to learn from a good manager because you don't see the mistakes and go, oh, well, I'm not going to do that because that was clearly
wrong.
I think it's, if you have a terrible manager, that's a very unpleasant experience, but at least you can see all the mistakes. Well, someone who's really good can be a bit invisible.
I learned from some of my management that I wouldn't necessarily say mistakes, but I learned things I did not want to do as a manager or lead.
Yes.
Because it makes the team uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that was actually part of my starting point. But I think it's one of those things where everyone's career path is going to be a bit different and these things will come in at different points. So I don't necessarily think you need to go and learn all of them all at once. I mean, some of the systems thinking, critical thinking stuff I got interested in when I was working on my first distributed system, which would have been sort of late 1990s, early 2000s, I think, somewhere around there, because I suddenly realized that linear thinking wasn't cutting it anymore. And I didn't quite understand I didn't even really know that what I was doing was linear thinking. It was just kind of how my brain worked. And I was very lucky that I sort of stumbled across systems thinking and went, oh, that's intriguing, at kind of the right moment. But at that point, I was still, I mean, I'd had been a manager once before, but at that point, I was basically an individual contributor again. I'd kind of stepped down a rung. It's kind of wherever you're in a position that's new, which tends to be around a promotion, but may not necessarily be around a promotion, I guess.
So I would like to yes and your answer. Having skimmed through the material and read bits of it that were really resonated with me, I think everyone should read them for a start, all the articles. And I think what would be interesting is if you're just starting out on your career, reading all these articles to get a sense of the fact that it's not just about technical skills, it's not just about writing code, and that's not enough. I think it might be a little bit overwhelming, but I think it can help you as you start on your career, open your eyes to other things that people aren't telling you need to be good at. But you can start thinking, if I was a bit better at my asynchronous communication, for example, I might be able to handle that conversation better. Or, you know, so if you read all of these things at the start of your career, it could open your eyes to opportunities, and then read it again as an intermediate and again as a senior, and you're going to get different things out of these different articles. Because I think all of these things are really important. I think the communication section, which is like the first section, that I think everyone should read as soon as possible. Because I have a big thing. We've talked a little bit about soft skills. We've talked a bit about interviewing. I have had for a long time a pet peeve that people put good communication skills on their CV as if these three words are enough to summarize what happens all day, every day as a part of a team, whether you're a manager, an individual contributor, or whatever. Good communication skills. It's like saying, you know, I'm a software engineer and I've done DevOps and I've done this and I've done all of that. And trying to summarize that as good technical skills. Like it's completely meaningless. Like what would that mean? Does that mean, are you talking about programming? Are you talking about picking up new technologies? Are you talking about being able to do systems? Are you talking about database? Like, what do you mean? Yeah. And good communication skills is just as broad. And it, even just in the three articles that you've got there, you already get a sense that communication skills is not just, oh, I can talk to a human being without them hating me. Like it's
yes.
So much more. I mean, there's written communication, there's verbal communication, there's synchronous, there's asynchronous. There's, you know, there's a very big difference between how you write something on Slack versus how you write an email. And I think understanding that right at the beginning of your career can really help you. It could supercharge your career if you can understand that and work on those skills very early on.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely agree. And it's really interesting. I mean, some of this has come up for me kind of pre-pandemic. I was a great advocate of remote work. I still am a great advocate of remote work. During the pandemic, we all kind of experienced remote work, but we experienced it in a really unfortunate way, which was, you know, kind of we had to. So it was all kind of done a bit on best endeavors and we kind of muddled through it. Intentional remote work requires a different form of communication from inter-office communication or in-person communication. And one of the things that I think people don't understand about remote working is the management style is completely different. And what that means is that different people will make maybe will be better managers in a remote situation than in an office situation. One of the reasons I think why a lot of people who are currently very senior, they are sort of pushing for return to office type things in various different ways is because their kind of power is being threatened by people working remotely, and that makes people very uncomfortable. But the real point is, written communication is different from in-person communication. How you go about it is a completely different thing. There are a core of things that are quite similar. One of the things that I kind of repeat quite a lot in the series is essentially about intentionality. It's about thinking through, what am I trying to do? What am I trying to get across ahead of time? One of my pet peeves is rocking up to a meeting where you've got, you know, like 12 very highly paid engineers in the room. And it's fairly obvious that the person who's called the meeting hasn't really got an agenda and hasn't really thought through the outcome that they want or what they're trying to achieve. And it's just a colossal waste of everybody's time. I think spending a bit of time thinking about, why am I having this meeting? Who needs to be here? Who doesn't need to be here? So you're doing it in a more efficient way. It's just a good thing to do. And sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes it's like, we have a problem. I have no idea what the answer is. Can we all gather around a whiteboard and try and figure something out? Fine.
Right. If you're doing brainstorming or mob programming, but that's the agenda, right? This is a thing. I want us all to talk about it. Yes. But then you come in with very different expectations to, I am going to information share this stuff with all of you because I need you to hear it from my mouth and then ask me questions. It's a very different type of meeting.
Yes. And by the same token, thinking about the channel, I think is really important as well. So understanding a Slack message is a different thing from an email, right? So understanding that those are different channels and they have different expectations attached to them, and maybe being explicit about what those expectations are.
Yeah.
So someone coming into the team knows that if I get a message on Slack, I'm sort of expected to respond to that immediately, if that's how you want to do it, or within 4 hours or something, maybe. If it's an email, 24 hours is fine. Sort of being explicit about what those expectations are so everybody knows what they are.
Yeah. And they're very cultural. Like you say, it's cultural to the individual organization or the individual team.
Yes.
So, because like some people would, if you're a culture where you expect an answer to Slack straight away, then you also, that implies you're a culture where you don't use Slack very often. Like it's really for very immediate stuff. You can't use it for everything.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, as part of that as well, there's a book I reference quite often called Deep Work by somebody called Carl Newport.
I've read like two of his books now. Like I love his stuff.
He's very, very good. And that particular book was one that really I really connected with. His point in Deep Work is essentially that interruptions, distractions of various kinds are absolutely deaf to thinking. And I think we all know that quite instinctively as programmers. It's why, you know, in many ways, the sort of trend towards large open plan offices is kind of a bit of a disaster, because particularly if you don't have enough private office space, private meeting space as well, you end up with people having meetings at their desks. And if you're trying to program, it's just murder. You sit there with your headphones on and music on or whatever, because you're trying to cut the noise out. Wouldn't it be easier if you just had an office? But my sort of general point with all of that is, again, it's just being intentional about how you communicate is really the key to making a lot of this stuff work, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Because I'm, as a developer advocate, I do a lot more communicating than most normal engineers, and I have way more channels to communicate. So do I mean, internally we have email and Slack, of course, but if I'm trying to communicate an idea to other engineers, is this a video? Is this a blog? Is this perhaps a webinar? Because like videos should be short, webinars are long. Do I expect interaction? Is it a conference talk? And if you give a conference talk, it's not necessarily the same as even a user group talk, that kind of thing. So you have these different media, different channels with different expectations, and having a bit of a grasp of that makes you, I was going to say makes you better at your job, but it allows your message, whatever it is, to be received better.
Yes.
So you have to understand what people are expecting when they listen to you on whatever channel it is.
Yes. Yeah. And thinking about who your audience is, which is always a key part of that as well. So it's what media am I using? But also, who am I addressing? Because obviously the way you talk to a group of engineers is going to be, I hope, different to how you talk to your executive team or your business. And something I find a lot in my, about half of my work is essentially consulting to various companies on various things. And one of the things that I get a lot is people in technical teams who are struggling to communicate with the business in various different ways. That's one of the sort of standard reasons that I get called in. And so often I'll be having conversations like, you know, oh, well, the business won't sponsor us to pay down technical debt. And I'm like, well, right. Have you explained to them what technical debt is? Actually,
and what the cost is.
Can you even explain that to me? Because I'll wager you probably can't, because it's one of those phrases we band around and kind of don't really know what it means, even as engineers. So how the hell is the business going to understand it? So again, I have an example in the shortcut of rather than saying that, if you can actually give them like, this is what we're seeing, this is why it's happening, this is how long we think it will take to fix, this is what the outcome we expect is, like, you know, I can't remember the example I give in the shortcut exactly, but it's something like, you know, we see 20% of our customers abandoning the shopping cart at checkout. We think this is because the mobile app is hanging. We think that it will take us about 4 weeks to fix that. And if we're right, we should see the abandonment drop by 15%, something like that. Then the business doesn't need to know that the reason that's happened is because you wrote the thing in a screaming hurry 6 months ago, and it's a dreadful pile of...
Right, and they don't want to hear that, you know.
And they don't want to hear that anyway. Like, who would, right? It's just like, but now I know, I as the business person can make an informed choice about that against the other things, the other competing priorities I have, but also I know what outcome you're expecting, and so I can then hold you to account if I don't get that outcome, and I can come back to you and go, well, okay, that didn't work, so do we still want to address this problem? What other theories do we have?
Right, and it allows you to focus as well, because then you are not necessarily... So often when I've said things like, I want to address technical debt, it's because I want to refactor all the code because I hate it and it sucks, right? But if you have like a business end goal, like reducing churn or like improving performance so customers don't leave because it takes too long to answer or whatever.
Yes.
Then you can focus on just the tasks which help you with that specific goal.
Yes, 100%.
I kind of mentioned briefly about things like conferences and presentations and stuff earlier on. So I contributed a little bit to one of your shortcuts around conference talks. And so there's one on presentations and there's one on conference talks.
Yes.
So my question to you really is, if an engineer isn't going to be a developer advocate like me, why do they need to learn to get better at public speaking?
Well, there's two answers to that. One is you'll probably have to do it at some point, whether you're a developer advocate or not. Right? It's a very common thing in business that at some point you will be asked to give a presentation. And what tends to happen to engineers who are asked to give presentations is they have a terrible time and they give a terrible presentation because it's not a thing that, again, it's not a thing that we sort of think about or do. So that's one answer to it. If you're talking about something like an internal presentation, that might be something like within the group of engineers, like a sort of internal tech conference type affair. But equally, it might be you're going off to a management sponsor team or something like that, another part of the business, to talk about some work that your team is doing or that you are doing. And being able to do that well, you know, if you can do it well, you'll have a better time, but your audience will have a better time as well, right? And that's really what this is about. It's about them coming away feeling like this person knows what they're talking about. So that's part of it. You slightly underplayed your contribution. So I interviewed you and Holly for one of those two pieces, but you also very kindly reviewed both of them and gave me quite a lot of feedback. So I'm very grateful to you for that. Because obviously your perspective as a developer advocate, but also as a woman, is different from mine as, you know, like a middle-class white English bloke. Those perspectives are going to be a bit different. So that's part of it, I think, is it is one of the things that you will have to do. And so knowing how to do it reasonably well is better for all concerned. I think the other thing is presenting stuff, whether that's at user groups or at conferences or wherever you do it, is another way of A, raising your profile a bit, which can be helpful from a career point of view, but also making connections to other people that are doing similar things and going through similar experiences to yours. A lot of the time with tech conferences, a lot of the best things, at least for me, a lot of the happiest things for me tend to be not actually in the session rooms at all. They tend to be over the coffee or over lunch or whatever it is in the pub afterwards, where you're hanging out with a group of fairly like-minded people, you have a bunch of things in common and you can talk shop or not, but that's where a lot of the learning actually happens. So one of the advantages of speaking at something like a tech conference is usually that you get to go to the tech conference for three, which is nice, right? Because it means you don't have to ticket.
And you meet these really cool, interesting people.
And you meet a great crowd. Like genuinely, in a lot of the better tech conferences, both the group of speakers, but also the audience are just really interesting people.
Yeah.
So for that reason, that reason alone, I find it really, really helpful. But it also comes, I think, for me, back to this thing of we need to get better at communicating as an industry. And that does mean having people that can stand up and talk about what they're doing and why. Because if we don't do that, then what's going to happen to us, I think, is we're going to get regulated by people who don't understand what the internet is.
Oh, God. What a terrible idea.
And that will be very bad. But also, because frankly, I increasingly think we are in danger of an industry of going down a very wrong path. And I think we need voices within the industry to be willing to call that out and point that out. So what I mean by that, for example, is from an environmental sustainability point of view, we are one of the few industries that are making the level of greenhouse gas emissions noticeably worse every year that we exist. We are increasing our greenhouse emissions at an alarming rate. But also we make other ethical choices, which I think are at best
questionable,
worthy of scrutiny.
Right.
Questionable, yes. You know, and I'm aware that ethics gets, you know, makes people very uncomfortable a lot of the time. But the thing is, you know, time was what we did wasn't as consequential, but it really is now. A lot of the work that we do, whether that's, you know, building a social platform or whether that's building, you know, like a predictive policing algorithm for a system or deciding whether somebody gets to leave prison or not, or, you know,
healthcare,
or all of these areas where IT is impacting. And what that means is, you know, we don't tend to teach ethics in computer science courses, but perhaps we should. We don't tend to teach sustainability in IT courses, but perhaps we should. And as I said, I think we need to get better at communicating what we're doing and why we're doing it for a whole variety of reasons. Because I think if we don't, there will be a tech backlash and it will be very bad for everybody that's in the industry and cares about it.
I think that's a very good point.
I kind of feel like we're at this, we're just about the right side of an inflection point, but we could go over it. And if we do, it will be very bad.
I had not thought of that. And now I'm going to worry about that all day.
Sorry.
But I think you're right. I mean, I've been thinking about ethics for a while, actually. I've seen, again, at conferences, I saw at conferences presentations about ethics probably 7 years ago. People were starting to vaguely talk about it. So before ML and AI became like as big as they are now. And ethics is a bit like security, but worse, in terms of like every developer knows, well, security, every developer knows they should care about it. They don't really know how to care about it, and they really hope that someone else is going to worry about it. And I think ethics is like that as well. I think we tend to assume, well, we don't really have a lot of control over what we're doing, and the boss says we have to do this, so we do it. And then we find out that we've created an algorithm which is denying poor people healthcare, for example, or whatever. Yeah. And you have to decide whether you're comfortable with that or not. And if you're not comfortable, we need to know what we can or cannot do about it.
So it's really interesting you mentioned that. So I was chief editor at InfoQ for about 6 years, and that was also quite heavily involved in the QCon conferences, which, so C4 Media is the sort of parent company of InfoQ and QCon. And so I was quite heavily involved in both. And we were pushing ethics quite hard when I was there. So we would have like an ethics track at 4 or 5 talks at QCons, and we did quite a lot of writing on it. And I got some, should we say, interesting email on the subject when we were doing that. You know, that's the life of a chief editor. Your inbox tends to be full of people who are, you know, unhappy of Tunbridge Wells. Fine. Then generative AI happened, and that sort of seems to suck all of the oxygen out of the room, rather. And everyone is now, and, you know, fair enough, like generative AI is it's a very significant moment in our industry, I think. Whether it's, I don't think it's as big a deal as the various hypers would have you believe, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be paying attention to it. But I worry that we've kind of lost sight of the implications of some of that work. And, you know, Cathy O'Neill, Weapons of Mass Destruction, came out probably a decade ago. And so much of the stuff that's in that book is still every bit as relevant today, but it's kind of like we've forgotten that. With AI specifically, there are all of these things around, you know, data collection and informed consent, where we kind of pay no attention to how the models are built, which makes me really uncomfortable. You have, you know, people in places like Kenya being paid $2 an hour to look at the very worst content of the internet, with all that you can imagine, like watching horrifying stuff hour after hour, day after day. We can imagine what that does to people. Are we okay with that? You know, like, I'm not, but you know, like, we should at least, if we're going to use these machines, we should at least have some understanding of how the thing is being made. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my specific and growing concern is mainly around sustainability. So it's mainly around greenhouse gases and climate change and those sorts of things. And that's kind of the drum that I'm personally banging. And with AI specifically, the way we are approaching AI is massively destructive from a climate change point of view. Like, it's really horrifying. But what makes me really angry is it doesn't have to be. Right? That is a choice that we are making as an industry. Basically, the choice is we don't care about future generations. We don't care about what happens to the planet after we're gone. We're quite happy to set fire to it so we can code faster.
Yeah.
Or whatever it is. And I just...
Or not faster. I was playing with an AI assistant yesterday. I asked it to generate me a unit test, and it took significantly more time than if I just asked my IDE to generate the outline of the unit test and I wrote the code myself.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I really want to talk about this more, because like, this is really interesting, but it's not the shortcuts that you wrote.
Sorry, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent. Sorry.
No, but I think, that you started in the right point, which is that we need to be able to communicate our thoughts, ideas, our concerns, and communication skills and platforms to communicate that is kind of part of that. So like, if you are an engineer who's worried about the ethics of the industry, if you are someone who wants to change something, like even in a small way, one of the reasons why I started blogging and ended up going to conferences is because the thing I wanted to change, I wanted to see more women in senior technical leadership positions.
Yep.
And Martin Fowler said to me, and I was complaining about it, and Martin Fowler was in the pub, you know, as you do, was working at ThoughtWorks at the time. And he said to me, you are one of the few people in a position to do that, because you can be writing and presenting and you can be visible and you can be a woman technologist and you can be the change you want to see. Mm-hmm. And that was 14 years ago, just before I became a developer advocate. It had a huge impact on me, on my career.
Yeah.
And I would like to think that I have had a small impact on the industry, because there is one more woman at conferences presenting about technical topics, not presenting about diversity in tech or whatever.
Yeah, well, 100%. And I think I really feel very strongly that that's the absolutely the right approach. It's like, if there is a thing you want to change, the only person that can make that happen is you. And going out and, as you say, going out and talking and being visible as a technical woman is a really valuable thing in and of itself. Because, you know, other people who are thinking, is this industry for me? If they're not seeing people like them, they're less likely to come in, for one thing.
Yeah.
But also just getting away from this idea that it's a sort of, I mean, it's very odd to me that programming has become this sort of weirdly male domain, because it wasn't and it shouldn't be. There was absolutely no logic.
It wasn't. It started off as women. The first computers were women who did the computing.
Well, all the way back to, you know, Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace.
Ada Lovelace
that was fixing all the maths, right? It wasn't Babbage who was doing that. Like, literally all the way back to the very beginnings of our industry, you think of people like Margaret Hamilton at NASA, and, you know, like,
Grace
the whole
Hopper
history of our image, our industry is, you know, most of the pioneers were women. And so the idea that somehow this is a male domain is just, it's very bizarre and odd to me. It's just wrong. But as you say, people have to, whether it's, as I say, in my case, it's climate, in your case, perhaps it's sort of women in more technical and senior technical positions. But whatever that thing is, you have a voice and you can make an effect. Have an effect is really important. And that might be within an organization, or that might be broader than that. But if you can communicate better, if you can get out and talk about what you're doing, that's how you can have an impact mm-hmm. at any level.
And so you can have an impact on the industry, but also it has an impact on your career. So sort of circling back to what we were saying, like the way to take control of your career, the way to get promoted, the way to get better jobs, all of these things is about, I mean, this is my opinion, not something you wrote, but like, it's about presenting the best version of yourself. It's not fake it till you make it. And it's not learning specific skills because that's where the money is. It's about being able to present yourself, what you're good at, what you care about, and all the best bits in order for you to get the promotion or get the better job or, you know, find your people. Like you said, at conferences, I love conferences because my people are there.
Yes.
You know, that's where my friends are, you know?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Same for me.
So there's one more thing I want to cover, because I know that we really could do with wrapping this up. In your section on blog writing, there was a question that you answered, which I think is relevant to both writing and presenting and conferences. Like, where do you get your ideas from? How do you decide what to write about or do a video on or do a talk on?
Yeah, that's a real perennial question for people, I think. And it's one of the standard questions that writers get asked all the time. You know, where do you get your ideas from? I don't know. I go to an idea shop and buy them. Obviously, everyone is a bit different in terms of where they get their ideas from. But I think there are certain things that are good to think about. So real experiences are always valuable, right? If I've done something, I think a lot of the time, we assume that if we know how to do something, then everyone must know how to do it. There's a kind of like a local bias.
I 100% agree with that statement. We assume that, and it's not true.
It's not true. And so often I've said to people, you know, you will have experiences that no one else in this room or this group has. And just by sharing that bit of information, you're doing something useful. I think sometimes we also make this assumption that we have to be like the expert in the thing to talk about it. And learning from experts is absolutely valuable.
It's usually really horrible because you have to already be at quite a high level to learn off an expert.
Yes, I think sometimes we undervalue that, you know, that first experience, that sort of early learner journey kind of thing. And that can be a really good source, particularly with something that's new or you know, comparatively novel. I mean, you know, none of us really know how to use generative AI and large language models yet. And if those things will turn out to have a use at all, we're only going to work that out by talking about, well, I found this was actually a really good use case. Well, this was not. You know, but like, those kind of things can be really valuable, I think.
I also agree that, so if you think about the adoption curve, so I've helped to run a whole bunch of user groups so that, you know, so you get a sense for which topics go really well in a user group. If it goes well in a user group, it probably go down well as a blog post or a conference talk too. And it is the introduction to the new and shiny. That always goes down well, but also stuff which is kind of like jumped the chasm of the adoption curve where yes. Now everyone is doing, I'm going to use cloud because that's the example that I really saw at the beginning was like hype. And now just everyone does cloud. Once it kind of just goes beyond that chasm, people are starting to pay attention and go, oh crap, cloud. For example, I didn't learn that when there was all this new and exciting and interesting stuff about cloud. And now I really need the bluffer's guide to cloud from people yes. who've been doing it in the earlier days.
I have a wonderful example of this from really early on in my career. And I was reminded of it because you mentioned that you'd worked at Thoughtworks and worked with Martin Fowler. So very early on in my career, I was working for a consulting firm and I got asked to go and work with, I won't name them, but it was a large retail bank in the UK. And I was asked if I'd go and work on this project, basically as an architect. And the Friday before I went, someone said to me, oh, by the way, they're using this thing called UML. And I'd not even heard of it. And I dashed into the PC bookshop in London, which mercifully still existed, and went, help. And the person there gave me a copy of a book called UML Distilled by Martin Fowler. And I literally read it at the weekend and rocked up on Monday morning. And everyone thought like I was this great UML expert that had been, but I'd literally not heard of it 2 days earlier. And it was because it was a brilliant book that conveyed everything that you needed to know in like 100 pages or something. It was fantastic. Obviously, UML is super unfashionable now. But the point is, you do get those moments in your career where you're like, ah, I've missed the important thing. And that book was
right.
Life-saving for me at the right moment. So absolutely. Funnily enough, at InfoQ, we used to, the kind of editorial plan that I had for InfoQ was to focus on technology that was to the left of the chasm that we were fairly confident would jump across. And that was kind of, so that sort of early stage stuff, but stuff that we thought had like real merit. So cloud, microservices, those kind of things would be very much at various points at that point. And it was exactly the same logic. It's like there are people who want to know this now, but there are also people who will be desperate to know it in like a year's time when suddenly it's right. everywhere. So yeah, absolutely. I think the sort of other, going back to the where do you get your ideas from question, I think the other thing is going to conferences or going to meetups or talking to other engineers and just hearing what problems they have. And if you go, oh, I know how to solve that problem. That's right. interesting. Maybe I should write a blog about that. Or
yeah. And you'll find a lot of those things, the things that you know really well are the things that you take for granted that everyone already knows.
Yes.
Because you do that, you do it every day. Maybe you all do it in your team or whatever. And so it's really useful to hear that kind of thing from other people at conferences or meetups where they're like, we don't know how to write unit tests or whatever. You're like, Oh, well, I do. And I know how to explain that really well. And you haven't even thought that there's an audience for that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, those are some of the examples. And the other thing I would say about all of these things is it's basically practice. It's like any other craft. In the same way that you learn to program by programming a lot, you get better at writing by writing a lot. You get better at speaking by speaking a lot. So there's not really a shortcut to that. You just have to sit there and do it and be willing to do it and be willing to make the odd mistake. And that's how you learn. With writing, with programming, I think if you get the opportunity to do pair programming or something similar to that, or again, code reviews can be horrid, but I think if they're done well, they have real value as well. With writing, if you're lucky enough to be able to write with an editor, who will actually give you feedback. And that's how I learned. That's how I got better, was someone going, this is terrible. Change all of this. This needs to, you know, like, and sometimes it can feel a little bit brutal, but it's absolutely how I got better at writing. And with presenting, it's kind of the same thing. You go out and do it. You start, you know, on an internal thing or a meetup or something. And hopefully people give you feedback and tell you what they think and what works and what didn't work. Or you get a feel for it from the what's happening in the room as you're speaking and you get better.
I have two top tips around there, actually. One, like 90% of the time, the stuff that you write, certainly at the beginning, if you're not well known in blogs and things, like most people won't even read that because they'll never come across it. So it's totally worth like practicing because there's very little to lose by sticking stuff out there because no one's going to pile on and go, what a load of crap, because almost no one will read it, which is sometimes a good thing, right? So that's one thing. And the other thing is, when it comes to things like this, you were saying, you know, you need the feedback to get better. And sometimes that feedback can be brutal. And that's true. But one of the other interesting things is, if you find that actually you're much better than you thought you were, you might not be amazing top notch, but like, so me and Kevin Henney, we edited 97 things every Java programmer should know, right?
Yep.
And so everyone submitted some pieces, which Kevin and I like lightly edited. We picked them, we put them together in a book. One of the things Kevin said before I came on board as a co-editor is that he said, my pieces didn't need any editing. They were like fine as they were. And I was like, well, A, that's nice, but B, oh, right. So other people write stuff which can be edited and that they can rely on someone else to make sure it looks good. And I didn't even know that kind of lower barrier to entry existed. I assumed my stuff had to be publishable right now. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, no. You know, you can just get stuff out there and make mistakes. And especially if you don't speak English as your first language, you don't need to worry too much about it. Engineers generally, when they read blogs or go to conference talks, they're happy if the meat of the content is interesting to them. They don't care as much if your grammar is correct or if you don't know what to do with your hands when you're presenting.
100%.
Like, obviously you can improve those skills, but when you start, most of that stuff just doesn't even matter.
Oh, so much so. And in fact, I mean, again, so going back to InfoQ and QCon, so we had the core thing with both InfoQ and QCon was that we took, so with InfoQ, we would find engineers who wanted to write and basically give them writing training. So that's sort of journalism 101 effectively, and then have them write. And the point was, yes, like a tech journalist will probably write better, but the engineer knows the subject better as a kind of rule of thumb. And likewise with QCon, we would get like first time speakers who'd never done a conference before, who were really great engineers. And on the whole, the audience wants you to succeed.
Exactly.
You know, so long as you're doing it in the right way, you're doing it, you're talking about things that you want to talk about, you're talking about things that you've thought about a bit and so on, the audience is absolutely on your side. They want you to do well, and they will absolutely tolerate it's not the most polished talk in the world, so long as they sense that you've actually put a bit of effort into it, I think. I want to add something else to this. I think, as just like a general observation, I think as engineers, we really are very bad at giving praise.
Yes.
And I think that we ought to be better at that. So I think if you're a manager of somebody, remembering to give praise, particularly praise in the moment, is just a really lovely, we all like to hear that someone feels that we're doing a good job on a thing. Likewise, if you go to a talk and you really enjoy the talk, or you really like the speaker, or you read a blog that you think is really good, or a book that you think is really good, spend 5 minutes, drop that person an email or, you know, hit them up on Mastodon or Blue Sky or whatever it is, and just say, that was great, I really enjoyed that. Sometimes, you know, about 50% of my time now is spent writing, and sometimes that can feel a lot like yelling in the void. It's really nice to know that there's someone out there who heard you and like you. You also tend to hear from the people who heard you and didn't like you.
Exactly.
So hearing from the people who enjoyed it and went to the trouble of saying, that was really good, or that was really worthwhile, or even, I thought that was really interesting, I wasn't quite, could you expand on this? I'm not really sure I agree with you about that. Have you thought about the other? It's all fine.
Yeah.
But mostly just going out and saying, I really like this. It's a really nice thing to do. It makes the world
a little
bay a better place.
It costs almost nothing, right? And so as a presenter, more than the writer side of things, but when people come up to me after a talk and say, thank you, I really liked it. Like, which,
yeah,
you know, it really makes your day. And it all, you know, you could be speaking to 100 people, and if one person does that, it's totally, it makes everything worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it goes back to this thing of, you know, I mean, it's a terrible cliche to say, you know, be kind, but really just taking that little bit of time to, when something is good, to say, that was good, I really enjoyed that, makes a big difference to people.
I say this with code reviews, because I spent a lot of time talking about code reviews when I worked at JetBrains, and I kept saying, it's not just about providing constructive criticism, having empathy and how people might receive your constructive criticism. Say nice things when you see good code. Take a second to write, oh, I really like this pattern.
Yeah.
Or good job with the naming here. Like, and maybe it might come across as patronizing, but it costs almost nothing to take 2 seconds to do that.
Yeah.
And I saw some arguments on the internet about, well, that's just not really, it's a bit of a waste of time and it's just noise in the code view. No, if you're talking about learning, and I do a lot of learning about learning, you want to reinforce the good habits. You want to reinforce the good patterns. So it's always valuable to say, this was good. If you want to see more of someone doing something, then you need to tell that person, this is the thing we want to see more of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I'm going to wrap it up because we've talked for 1,000 years. But thank you so much. Like, this was a fantastic conversation. And we got to talk about all these things that I really feel very passionately about, like soft skills and good communication skills. And I highly recommend anyone who's watching this to read the articles, because it doesn't really matter what level in your career you are. Maybe some will resonate with you and maybe some won't, but I think some stuff is going to stick in your head about, oh, I haven't really thought about developing these skills, or, oh, I could do that now and that would really help me. So I highly recommend it. Thanks very much, Charles. Do you have anything else to say before we stop the recording?
No, that was wonderful, Tricia. Thank you so much. Absolute pleasure to chat to you, as always. And
it's always a pleasure.
Really enjoyed that. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.